Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Assassinated former Pakistani Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto now lies in her family's grave. There are riots in her home province and across the country. Al-Qaeda has claimed a victory in killing a key American ally, but no one knows for sure. Pakistan and the whole region shudder at the implications of it all. And whatever imperfect hopes the U.S. had that Pakistan would hold elections, choose a Western-friendly democratic government, and move decisively against a growing Al-Qaeda-Taliban threat within its borders, well, those hopes lie more or less in ruins. This hour on Point, facing the future without Benazir Bhutto. We have very insightful voices in Pakistan waiting by phone to join us, and we are so far unable to get through. A lot of calls going to Pakistan today. If we do get through, we'll bring them in. In the meantime, we begin today in Washington with Helene Cooper of the New York Times, who has closely covered the U.S. State Department's efforts, heavily centered on Benazir Bhutto, to bring stability to Pakistan. Helene Cooper, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Can you please describe to us, just to get going here, the role of the United States in the very return of Benazir Bhutto to Pakistan? What role did Washington play in getting her back there?
Well, Bhutto, the idea of going back to Pakistan was Bhutto's idea. She wanted to go. But the United States did seize on that fairly quickly, and it's incorrect to say that we brokered her return, because she was going to go anyway, and she was in talks with the Musharraf people. But we certainly did support it. She has a lot of strong relationships and has had a lot of relationships in Washington. She's studiously courted both Democrats and Republicans, people in Congress, and the United States saw, particularly the Bush administration, saw her return as a way to salvage President Musharraf's presidency. He has been increasingly unpopular in Pakistan, as you know.
Yes. Helene, you write today that the administration had been fighting so hard, amid some skepticism, to, your words, broker an agreement in which the increasingly unpopular Musharraf would share power with Ms. Bhutto. After these elections, which were supposed to come up here, what was the nature of that? What was hoped for in that power sharing? How would that have worked?
The idea, which did have a lot of skepticism, you're right, was that neither party, neither Musharraf's party or Bhutto's party, the PPP, were going to win enough votes in the parliamentarian elections to have an outright majority. So the hope was that Musharraf and Bhutto would then form some sort of an alliance.
He as president, she as prime minister.
He would be president, she would be prime minister. And, you know, because he has the army on his side, the army, which is quite skeptical and hasn't really liked Bhutto, has been quite suspicious of her, would go along with this. That was the hope. But from the very beginning, there are a lot of people pouring cold water on that, just because Musharraf and Bhutto don't get along very well. I mean, they don't hate each other as much as Musharraf and Nawaz Sharif, who was Bhutto's successor, hate each other. But one administration official likened the idea of Bhutto and Musharraf as the idea of putting two pythons in a cage together and telling them to get along.
And now Bhutto is dead. Did the United States government make any promises to Benazir Bhutto prior to her return to Pakistan about her security, her personal safety, or what steps the U.S. and through its pressure Musharraf might take to guarantee that security?
I don't think so. None of my reporting has shown any promises made from the United States to guarantee Bhutto's safety. I interviewed her in August at the Algonquin Hotel, and she was very aware at the time that this was going to be very dangerous. I mean, you saw what happened when she got there in August.
Immediately, on the day of her return.
The day of her return. I mean, more than 100 of her supporters were killed in a suicide bombing. Everybody knew, and she was certainly well aware of the fact that security was going to be an issue. I think it was seen as more, something for Musharraf to take care of. The Bhutto people in the last day have been making a lot of accusations about Musharraf not providing enough security for Bhutto. And that, again, goes back to the that's almost, in some ways, it seems as if it's almost an immediate type of knee-jerk response. That goes back to the idea of how, given how much suspicion there is between the two sides, how were we really going to see them?
But let me ask you something, Helene. Given that the United States has poured $10 billion into this country and its military since 9/11, and given the enormous importance, significance that the U.S. State Department was placing on Bhutto herself, her person, in the formula of Pakistan, couldn't Washington have put the pressure on Musharraf to put an impregnable bubble around this woman in Pakistan? She was complaining that the security she'd offered was shabby and full of holes.
I know, but she was killed because she was standing in a sunroof in a bulletproof car. What's the point of being in a bulletproof car if you're going to stand up in a sunroof?
She's a politician.
Well, but and that's one of the things that you get into as you look at the whole idea of mass rallies and campaigning in Pakistan. I mean, I don't think you can. It's part of how the Bhuttos have long done it. You know, part of her appeal is, particularly in the countryside, with the population, has been that she's out there wanting to reach out and touch. But you don't see a lot of people here in the United States doing that. We haven't seen that much of that since John F. Kennedy.
The United States put a lot of chips on this woman and her political support in Pakistan, knowing full well how she would...
I would disagree with that. I don't think the United States put that many chips in Bhutto. They put their chips in Musharraf. The whole point of getting Bhutto to go back and supporting this deal was to prop up Musharraf. It was not because they wanted to see Bhutto as prime minister.
But without that prop of Bhutto, and I hate to put it that way, many people, of course, see her as much more than that, but without that, he was reeling just months ago, and is the State Department now concerned he'll be reeling again within months, days, weeks?
I think everybody's very concerned. I mean, that's one of the most predictable, one of the only predictable things about Pakistan is that it's completely unpredictable. Our ability, I think, to influence events inside Pakistan is extremely limited.
Is there any alternative to Benazir Bhutto in Washington's view at this point? Someone else who could step up, run for office, become prime minister, and give a democratic face to the Musharraf government, if indeed that's the option?
It's kind of funny, the idea of a democratic face to a government that's
that came in by military coup.
Yeah. I don't know, and that's sort of what the people at the State Department are scrambling to figure out now. Nawaz Sharif, who is really hated, I mean, by Musharraf, is probably has as much popularity as Bhutto, but he announced yesterday that he was withdrawing from the. That he wasn't going to run in the elections because he didn't think that they could be fair. I think there's a lot of going through the Rolodex right now in the United States. But again, your question presupposes that we have the ability to determine who will be prime minister of Pakistan. We don't.
Helene Cooper, a final question. At this point, where is Washington looking most intently for culpability around this murder, this assassination? We have some sort of raggedy internet al-Qaeda claims of responsibility, but of course the Pakistan's own intelligence services have come in for scrutiny, and Musharraf himself, her impassioned grieving supporters in the streets are blaming the U.S. they're blaming. Where's the U.S. looking at this point?
The first thing President Bush and a lot of the people in the Bush administration that I talked to yesterday were pointing to was al-Qaeda, but that's in a minute, that's not because they have any proof. It was sort of almost, again, a knee-jerk reaction, but that was certainly the first group that the President Bush did not specifically say al-Qaeda, but he said militant Islam, Islamic extremists and terrorists, and that sort of code word for al-Qaeda. They seem to be looking in that direction.
Mm. Helene Cooper, diplomatic correspondent for The New York Times. Helene, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
With me in the studio, Adil Najam, professor of global public policy at Boston University, director of the Pardee Center for the Study of Long-Range Future there. Pakistani himself, watching all this with the rest of the world, and Pakistan in particular, over the last day. Adil Najam, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much.
The finger of responsibility. It's only a day since this tragic event has unfolded in Pakistan. You're hearing the same rumblings and suspicions as everyone else in the world at this point, and the same angry shouts in the streets of Pakistan. Is it too soon to begin to pin responsibility somewhere, given the wide range of options, people who might have wished Benazir Bhutto ill?
I think there isn't the evidence, but the responsibility, certainly the likely culprit is quite clear, that by far it is the religious extremists who have the most to gain from this. The government of General Musharraf may be, you could claim that they might have been, they could have done more, but I do not think it was willful negligence, because they don't gain much from it. They actually lose a lot of credibility.
And what about the religious extremists within the military, and in particular the intelligence services of Pakistan? Or are you looking more purely toward Al-Qaeda, Taliban?
I don't no longer know what Al-Qaeda is, mm-hmm. but this rise of the Pakistani Taliban, the new Taliban who are within Pakistan, and what has been happening in Swat, in the north of Pakistan, in the border with Afghanistan.
Only within Pakistan, but now in Rawalpindi, the garrison city within, a few miles of the capital.
Yeah. So I really think it is more there than within the intelligence agencies. There is a pattern to this. If you look at the last 8 months, a year, there is two types of bombings that have been happening, and happening very consistently through the emergency, through everything. One is go to a crowded place, especially near a military base, blow people up, leave your visiting card, we were here, we can hit. The other is very targeted killings at these prize trophies, if you will, at President Musharraf himself, at the Prime Minister, at the Interior Minister only a few days ago, at Benazir earlier, at Benazir now. This is the first of those high-profile message sending.
And Benazir Bhutto now assassinated, now at this point buried in her family's mausoleum in the south of Pakistan. Adil Lajam, please stand by. There's much more to come. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about the aftershocks of the death of Benazir Bhutto, Pakistan's future, and U.S. security on the dark side of a major assassination. Benazir Bhutto buried today in the Islamic tradition very quickly after her assassination yesterday in Rawalpindi, the garrison town military headquarters just outside Pakistan's capital of Islamabad. Benazir Bhutto, a major figure, many hopes in the United States had been pinned on her somehow getting into a kind of power-sharing arrangement with former president now, Pervez Musharraf, in whom the United States has invested so much, particularly since 9/11. Just a couple of months after 9/11 2001, I spoke with Benazir Bhutto. I asked her about the prospects for democracy in the Muslim world.
Most of the Islamic world has non-democratic governments, but their people want freedom. And in a sense, they feel that they are outside decision-making, and there's a lack of accountability, and there's a lack of transparency. But because there's been a non-democratic culture that has come into being, there are very few democratic alternatives. Mm-hmm. And the alternatives are really the clerics or the clerical-backed movements. So we are in a very difficult situation. I am arguing that the Muslim world must be given a third choice, that is a democratic choice. But right now, most countries have a choice between a Western-backed dictator and between a clerical-backed dictator or dictatorship.
Benazir Bhutto on December 21st, 2001, just a couple of months after 9/11. And, of course, she now returned to Pakistan and assassinated. I've been joined by Adil Najam of Boston University, and right now from Washington by Stephen Cohen, senior fellow in foreign policy at the Brookings Institution, longtime scholar of India and Pakistan, author of The Idea of Pakistan. Stephen Cohen, thank you very much for joining us.
Good to be with you, Tom.
The United States, it looks to me, was putting some very large hopes on Benazir Bhutto, and she is now gone. Where does that leave American policy in this country, in this region?
Well, I think that America came to Benazir too late and too strongly. In a sense, we turned to her, or the administration turned to her, because we were trying to save Musharraf by broadening his political base. Mm-hmm. And had we done this much earlier, and had we reached out to other Pakistani politicians, I think we'd be in a very different position than we are now. I think there's a fundamental miscalculation on the part of the Bush administration, as in the case of Russia. They assumed that one strong leader who you knew personally, the president knew Putin and Musharraf personally, could carry America's baggage or garbage, whatever you prefer, in the case of Pakistan and the so-called war on terrorism. And clearly Musharraf was never up to this kind of challenge. He wasn't interested in it. I think he's a man who lacks the kind of imagination and vision to even be a competent dictator. I met him shortly after his coup, and I urged him, I urged him, in fact, to sort of hold new elections, you know, let the personalities compete again and let the Pakistani people judge. He dismissed that out of hand. He said, no, this time we're really going to fix them. We're going to rebuild the system in our own way. And they tried to rebuild Pakistan in the image of the army. But, you know, you cannot govern a modern state, especially a multi-ethnic, multi-religious state of 150 million people, by issuing orders from army headquarters. It just doesn't work. So I think that was a failure. It was going to be a failure from day one, and the U.S. compounded it by reinforcing this failure by emphasizing him. Now I think there's some in the administration who understand that this was a mistake, and they're trying to back out quickly.
But that was many years of backing Musharraf without really pushing hard for democracy there. Helene Cooper says Benazir Bhutto of the Times, who we spoke to earlier, says Benazir Bhutto herself very much wanted to go back. But clearly Washington had its hands all over this return at the same time. Should the United States somehow have done more to try and guarantee her security in this hyper-volatile environment, Stephen Cohen? Did the United States somehow let Bhutto down once she plunged back into the fire?
I think that's a reach. I just don't know the evidence there that we, you know, in a sense, we couldn't send American contingents to protect her in Pakistani soil. I don't know if we tried or not, but some of her supporters say that we actually did urge Musharraf to provide more security, and they urged the Pakistan government to provide it. I don't know the facts of the matter, but that will come out eventually. But I think the real issue is we should have not personalized it in her case. Let me point out that the British and other countries were equally behind this, the return of Benazir to Pakistan. It wasn't just an American invention. I think the U.S. should have, from the earlier, and even when she returned, said we're interested in supporting all responsible political parties who are willing to participate in an election in a constitutional manner. And that would have included the Islamists, and it would have included Nawaz Sharif and others. And certainly the American ambassador in Pakistan, Ambassador Ann Patterson, has done this. She's been very active. She's met with all the political parties and political personalities in Pakistan. I think the failure was back in Washington.
Adil Najam, give us a Pakistani perspective here. I mean, of course, Washington has large interests, but this is first and foremost Pakistani politics and a Pakistani loss. Do you see, was there a realistic possibility of many people are saying she very likely would have become prime minister only days or weeks from now. Could she somehow have balanced Musharraf? Would it have been more than a democratic veneer? Could there have been was there a realistic chance of some kind of power sharing here, which would have moved Pakistan in a new direction when Musharraf still had the power of the military, even without his uniform behind him?
I think it was always a pipe dream. It was always a pipe dream, and a really bad pipe dream at that, that if in fact it had happened, it would have been a very uneasy relationship, and we would have been here talking about all the other mess it would have created.
Does that mean Bhutto herself was pipe dreaming? She was at the heart of this.
I think this Washington plan to manage Pakistan. Pakistan can't be managed. Countries can't be managed. Mm-hmm. They can be supported. But this idea that you can manage a country, especially a country like Pakistan, has never been a good idea. Just to add to, I think what Steve and Helena are saying are exactly right. When you ask the question, you know, could the U.S. have done more on security, I'm also not sure if they could. But they could have done less on pushing her and anointing her. By becoming the anointed U.S. Personage, she actually became a bigger target for the extremists. And if the extremists are behind it, they are sending a message not as much to General Musharraf, but also to the West. In some ways, I would argue that this might be the biggest victory for them since 9/11.
When you say them, you mean Islamic radicals. We have this one claim, at least, on an obscure Italian website, commander of Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, and telling a reporter in a phone call, so who knows?
But
being quoted saying, we terminated the most precious American asset, which vowed to defeat the Mujahideen.
Yeah. I don't put much faith in that claim, but here's the irony. Even if the Islamist extremists didn't do it, they can take credit for it. It's still a victory for them. Because in some ways, they've been saying that we want to do this. They've been saying we will do this for the last many months. So for their support base, they can actually claim claim important points and destabilize what is obviously the epicenter of the war on terror.
I want to bring in another voice here, but let's listen first just for a moment. Candidates on the campaign trail in the United States have been talking a lot about this in the last 24 hours. Here is Senator Joe Biden, of course, touting his foreign policy credentials, but warning of the possible consequences for the region in the wake of the Bhutto assassination.
Ladies and gentlemen, the stakes are incredibly high. They are incredibly high. If Pakistan falls into complete turmoil, martial law is declared again, you end up with a state that is being run by a dictator. Ladies and gentlemen, that does not bode well for Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, India.
Joining us right now, also from Washington, Ellen Leibson is here, president and CEO of the Henry L. Stimson Center, non-policy policy institute there. She directs the Southwest Asia Project, focusing on a range of security issues in the Gulf region and beyond. Ellen Leibson, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Tom. Glad to be with you.
Pakistan has been, the powder keg for a long time, and now we have Bhutto in her family mausoleum. How do you see the consequences here? There's Joe Biden looking right across the region. Uncertainty in Iraq, belligerence in Iran, Afghanistan slipping backward recently, and now Pakistan returning to something like potentially chaos here. What comes out of this, Ellen?
Well, this is a breathless moment where we are imagining some worst-case scenarios. Pakistan has always been a volatile country whose politics have not been stable for basically the two generations that have ruled Pakistan since its independence, and it does live in a rough neighborhood. But let's put a few things in perspective. First of all, we have sometimes, feared that Pakistan was a failing state, et cetera, and yet some of its national institutions, the military in particular, have been able to maintain some semblance of order in the country. Now, that has a downside. It means that Pakistan has not made as much progress on democratization as I think many Pakistanis would have wanted.
And it's not just a hand-waving worrywart. So, it was Richard Haass yesterday. This is the former director of policy planning at the State Department saying Pakistan is on the brink of becoming a failed state.
It has weak institutions. That is clearly one of, weak institutions other than the military. Mm. There has been an over-reliance on a security culture, and the United States has contributed to that mindset in a way by usually putting security ahead of other considerations in our relationship with Pakistan. What I wanted to say was that, we have tended to orient our policy towards other regional concerns, as you mentioned, Iran, Afghanistan, India. But a few of those things are changing. We are less worried about prospects for an India-Pakistan war, for example. We are on the ground in Afghanistan, so we're not expecting Pakistan to do all of our bidding. We are doing some of it ourselves. Now, that, again, has agitated some players in Pakistan and has not made Pakistan's internal situation any easier. But I'm just raising the possibility of whether it's time to focus on Pakistan as Pakistan, and not always from this regional perspective where we always put security ahead of other considerations. I do think there's a little bit of a leadership vacuum in the PPP now, and we will have to watch that party decide. There isn't a natural Bhutto family member to be the successor, so we will watch what could be a movement in the direction of more normal political succession for the party. I think that will be hard. Benazir is clearly now a martyr, and there will be a lot of attention placed on her and her family's dynasty and legacy. But, I think we will need to see whether a new leader emerges. Nawaz Sharif, since he's returned, has turned out to be strangely popular, even though he was tainted and, like Benazir, suffered from allegations of corruption and was not seen necessarily as such a successful leader when he had been prime minister. So there's a lot in play right now, but I guess my point is that maybe it's time to really focus on Pakistan's stability and viability and not always be using Pakistan as an instrument to some other security objective.
And yet it's not only Washington that has come to see Pakistan in that way. Islamic fundamentalist radicals themselves doing that, and the reach of those in western Pakistan, apparently reaching right into Rawalpindi yesterday, Ellen.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is true. In Pakistan, you know, we, at least the government claims that they are not completely controlling their borders, that there are some external elements that have managed to, you know, make a foothold in Pakistan and are causing some of the problem. But let's be honest, even if one were to point the finger at Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda must be finding some, you know, partners and allies inside Pakistani society that have allowed it to do its deeds, if in fact it turns out that they're responsible for this assassination.
Let's take a call from Northampton, Massachusetts. Guy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
And welcome back.
Thank you.
Tom, my question is this. Given the fact that Al-Qaeda is prone to the spectacularity of their attacks and seek the most vulnerable points to attack and want to create the most instability, and given the fact that, of course, they're meeting resistance with the U.S. forces and the U.N. forces in Afghanistan and Iraq,
yeah.
Is anyone considering the fact that this is a redirection of their efforts towards a spectacular attack in the region to create the maximum amount of instability and chaos?
Stephen Cohen, we've seen that speculation just in the last 24 hours that Pakistan may at this point be the most inviting target for Al-Qaeda, whatever label you want to put on the Islamic radical movement. How do you see that, Stephen?
You know, I hate to be rude, but facts, you know, facts can't be ignored. The fact has been that there were at least 7 or 8 major bomb blasts, terrorist attacks, within Islamabad, within Rawalpindi, within 2 miles of where she was killed.
Mm-hmm.
And none of this is Al-Qaeda. This is all done by Pakistanis, with Al-Qaeda inspiration, but by Pakistanis and groups based in Pakistan. And some of this may well have been done with military support. There's no question that Al-Qaeda is interested in destabilizing Pakistan, but there's a homegrown Al-Qaeda. There's a Pakistani radical movement. Some of this was supported and financed originally by the Pakistan Army. I think the real issue is not whether there's intent in the case of the army, and it goes back to Ellen Lapson's point about the army being the strongest institution in Pakistan. That may be the case, but the strongest institution in Pakistan is simply unable to manage affairs in its own country. It's unable to to change itself from its focus on India. It has been unable to reorganize itself towards domestic terrorism. It has, in fact, been supporting some terrorist groups such as Taliban with one hand while claiming to suppress them with the other hand. So I think the issue is not intentions, but it's simply competence. And Pakistan isn't a failed state, but it is a failing state. A number of its institutions have already collapsed, yet it is, compared with most Middle Eastern countries, still has some potential for democracy. I think the administration's failure was to understand that they were dealing with an institution in the army, which was not capable of carrying the load we assigned to it, which was to, you know, stabilize and modernize Pakistan. Let me get back to one other point
Please.
Made earlier in terms of the return. Benazir, I think the best answer for whether she should have gone back or not was Benazir's own statement. She said, and I think she was absolutely correct on this, that for years the United States supported military autocracies in Pakistan, and there was no shame in supporting leaders who wanted to change that. And I think that her last words were, in fact, you know, something to the effect that it's about time the Americans finally, you know, stopped supporting just the military, supported civilians. So I think that, to me, the notion that we forced her to go back or made her go back, and this was some kind of American responsibilities, is one of the more absurd things I've heard. She knew what the risks were. She faced the risks. She may not have had adequate protection, but she violated what protection she did have by plunging into crowds. She felt that her role as a Democratic politician was to engage with people, and she turned out to be tragically incorrect in the terms of the risk that she faced in Pakistan.
Do you see a major loss to State Department hopes in her death? Do you see them as having hoped that she would give a democratic face to what was essentially would have continued to be Musharraf power?
I don't think the State Department had anything to do with this. This was a policy that has been from the beginning after 9/11 made at the very top of our government. And there were always a few people who felt that, you know, Musharraf was not the strongest reed in the world, that we should have brought their support. One of those was Zalmay Khalil's out, who's been discussed in the New York Times, as our ambassador to the UN. So I think the State Department simply went along with policies that were made in the White House.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the aftershocks of the assassination of Benazir Bhutto, Adil Najam is with me, professor at Boston University. Stephen Cohen is here, senior fellow in foreign policy at the Brookings Institution, and Ellen Lapson from the Henry L. Stimson Center in Washington. Right now, Sulpan is calling from Salem, New Hampshire. Sulpan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you think?
Please, I have 2 points. Just bear with me, a little patient. First of all, my condolences to her family and her supporters.
Yes.
And my two part is, one is her legacy. I think we were, betting was on the wrong horse. So she got twice elected, and then her times, Pakistan became second most corrupt country in the world.
When you say we bet on the wrong horse, who's we, Sulpan?
The United States and Western, supporters. And
but wasn't it Pakistanis who elected her both of those times?
Well, that's right. But Pakistanis were also, they did not want to get a chance to bring that, gave him chance twice, and she was corrupt, unbelievable. But other thing is that, and then she was very political opportunist. Her father ran and won prime ministership on anti-Americanism, and now she is first returning back on pro-Americanism. So she's a political opportunist all along the history of the party. But the thing is that since we expect 100% loyalty from Pakistan or Muslim countries, so she was doing all kind of things, all kind of right things. There's music to over here, and we're making him larger than life. Now, that is a legacy. From moving on, I think the best thing for Pakistan is if U.S. is sincere, another person, that they should counsel Musharraf to reinstate the judiciary. The people who had confidence in Pakistan, you have confidence that those judges and the Supreme Court.
Yep. Bring them back. Yep.
Maybe the Supreme Court judge could be an interim prime minister to hold elections. So the people have a lot of confidence in the election, rather than Musharraf appointing our own crony to supervise the election. So I think we should bring somebody who has trust of the people, and the most trusted people I know, more respectable, is ex-Supreme Court judge Mr. Khar Chaudhry and some of the associates. They are the people who can really, really put the things together.
But they're the very ones that Musharraf has very deliberately pushed off of the power center. Sultan, thank you for your call. Adil Najam, what about this combination that Benazir Bhutto appeared to bring to Pakistan? That is, many people thought she would be prime minister within days from now, and yet she was understood to be moderate and in many dimensions pro-Western. Now, explain to us how that works in Pakistan. We see a lot of anti-Western sentiment in Pakistan. What was the heart of Pakistan that she was appealing to?
She's always part of her appeal is the last name Bhutto. Bhutto carries a lot of weight in Pakistan, as you well know. She does have a mixed legacy, maybe a tainted legacy. There were many people who were very concerned. While it was clear that she would become prime minister in a few days if elections were held, it wasn't clear that she would have a resounding victory. It was not even clear that she would actually win a majority. In some ways, and to General Musharraf's liking, the likelihood would have been a very hung parliament with various parties having a fragile number of seats, which would have actually allowed him to hold on to power. He actually wanted that sort of a divided. So let's also not overplay her popularity. I think in many ways her popularity was further became less credible because of the recent U.S. support, because of that anti-Westernism that you talk about. There is a large. Pakistan is a complex society. Mm. There is a large anti-U.S. sentiment in Pakistan, as it is in many parts of the world, but at its heart it does remain a democratic and liberal society, at least in desire. And she played to that. She appealed to that. The question is, where does one go from here? The PPP is now routed. That doesn't have obvious leadership. It could be her husband, Asif Ali Zardari. It might be someone else. The big question, I think, one of the many big questions before Musharraf right now is, do the elections go on or not? And he's in a catch-22 here. If he postpones them, the charge would be, maybe rightly, that that's what he always wanted to do. His pull the plug from democracy.
Dead. Elections are off.
If he does hold them, I think the honest view is there won't be much of an election. There wouldn't have been much of an election even if she were alive, because it's kind of pre-rigged already. So there is a bind. So the second part of the caller's question, I think, has something in it. He needs to make a very bold move. If he wants to do anything, he needs to make a very bold move. Part of which is an apology for what he's done over the last year. Part of which is making credible moves towards real democracy. That includes restoring the judiciary. That includes making sure that it is a real, clean, fair election, even if it is in a few months rather than in a few days.
Let's go to Pakistan right now, to Lahore, Pakistan, and the journalist there, Ahmed Rashid, a tremendous observer of all things going on in Pakistan and the region. Ahmed Rashid, thank you very much for joining us. We're sitting in the United States speculating today about Pakistan's way forward. From where you sit in Lahore, do you see a real possibility of a democratic way forward, or is it back to the full military grip?
Well, I think things are looking very black at the moment and very grim indeed. I think the real strategic implications of Benazir's assassination is simply that now there is no politician or general in Pakistan who is willing to stand up to the extremists. We've seen already with President Musharraf a lot of double dealing on this issue of dealing with the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. Bhutto was the one politician who was taking a very firm line against it. She's been gunned down. None of the other politicians are going to take that kind of position. So what this means is that I think there's going to be a lot of space now being taken by the extremists. They're going to gain ground, and they're going to turn this country upside down. That's the first thing. I think the second thing is that the army is now facing an enormous quandary. It is being abused and disliked. At least five or six soldiers have been murdered today in Sindh province, where the funeral took place of Bhutto. There's enormous anger against the army and the military. If they try and do a coup again, if they try and come into power, I don't think they can sustain any kind of martial law.
Ahmed Rashid, what does it mean for the extremists to gain ground? They already appear to hold a significant bit of ground along the Afghan border. If her assassination was at the hand of extremists, that's a lot of ground. What does it mean for them to gain more ground? What would that look like in Pakistan?
Well, I mean, you know, it would really look like a slow but a very bloody meltdown, in which we've already seen that in fighting the Pakistani Taliban, the army has lost large numbers of men and hundreds have surrendered. So there's a very serious problem of demoralization in the military. The politicians are not willing to stand up to these extremists the way that Benazir Bhutto was doing. So there seems to be very little at the moment to stop them gaining more ground. And I think, you know, the worst-case scenario would be then that in 2 or 3 months' time, if this situation continues, we get more attacks by the extremists and more attacks in Afghanistan, you may well see some kind of American intervention in Pakistan. And that, in my opinion, would be also a disaster, because that would then be pitting, even if the Americans were to bomb some of the tribal areas where these extremists are based, you would have a very serious crisis here.
Let's listen, if you would, with us for just a moment, Ahmed Rashid, to one of our presidential candidates here in the United States, Ron Paul in the GOP, who's been a singular voice, kind of iconoclastic, but very clear-spoken. He was saying yesterday the United States should not have supported Musharraf's military dictatorship in the first place.
He overthrew an elected government, and we reward him by supporting him. He becomes our puppet. We've sent him about $10 billion over the last 8 years. And the candidate that represents democracy, Bhutto, comes in and she gets killed. And we're right in the middle of this. And we just sort of stir the pot. And now I'm scared to death that we're going to be marching in there and have another war. We have one in Iraq. We threaten Iran. We're in Afghanistan. We can't afford to go in. And now go into nation building in Pakistan. I think it's a consequence of us getting involved too many places.
Ahmed Rashid, leave the United States role aside for a moment. You say in Benazir Bhutto's absence, no Pakistani politician is going to go hard to stand up against the extremists. Can you explain why not? Isn't there a constituency in Pakistan for resistance to what the extremists represent?
Well, you know, what we've seen over the last 7 years, despite all the bonhomie that exists between President Bush and President Musharraf, Musharraf has essentially been playing a double game with the Americans. He has essentially been willing to go against the Arab component of Al-Qaeda, but he's been quietly allowing the Taliban, the Afghan Taliban, and the Pakistani Taliban to revive themselves on Pakistani soil. Now, that's been done for a variety of strategic reasons in which Pakistani fears of India, Pakistani mistrust of the Afghan government, etc., all come into play. But what we have really seen is this double play. And as a result of this, all the politicians who have been with the army for the last 7 years are compromised. They have been in cahoots, you know, with the Islamic parties and with a lot of these extremist groups. Not a single one has come out against extremism. And even the second largest opposition leader, the former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, who returned from exile recently, even he has been playing it very softly, with the religious parties and with the extremists. And if he was to win an election, it would be expected that he would probably form an alliance with some of the religious parties who themselves are linked to the extremists. So really, the whole issue was that Bhutto's return and hopefully Bhutto's success at the election was going to be a very pivotal and strategic shift in direction for Pakistan and for the Western backers of Pakistan. Because Bhutto would add a degree of respectability to the democratic process, a degree of legitimacy, at long last there would be a representative government, and at the same time this government would be pushing the military to get tough on the extremists. Now that whole scenario has gone out of the window.
Adil Najam, Ahmed Rashid in Lahore sees a bleak black future. We're looking for the light here. Is there not a constituency for another moderate voice? Is Benazir Bhutto really the only one who could have rallied, mustered that view?
I also see a bleak future, but I think there might be hope. I don't know if there is, but there might be hope. I think part of the reason why, as Ahmed rightly said, the extremists gain ground is General Musharraf is so very unpopular that his core base, the people who should be with him, the people who should be against the extremists, are so angry at him that they are directing their anger at him. So if you look at this, even people who believe that the extremists were behind this, who do they express their anger at? General Musharraf, because he has made himself by his actions so very, very unpopular. Look at who's been protesting against him. Journalists.
Yes.
Lawyers.
Yes.
Students. The liberal, secular, pro-Western people who were supposed to be his core are now his biggest opponents. So what has happened here is not only that the space for the extremists has increased, but the space for General Musharraf's brand of moderateism has so shrunk. He has lost so much credibility that people's anger is directed at him. So I think the first step has to be either a removal or a real curtailment of him, especially now that he doesn't have the uniform. And if that happens, maybe the moderate voices will rise. I do have hope. I don't know. I'm not a big fan of Nawaz Sharif. But my point has always been the same. Have democracy. Whoever will come, if they have the support of the people, they will buy into the U.S. argument and start fighting this war more seriously, certainly more seriously than he is.
Ahmed Rashid, a last word from you in Lahore. As far as U.S. support and policy and the weight of its hopes go now, is where could they be usefully focused at this point, or should the United States just stand back and let Pakistanis sort this out?
Well, no, but I really think what is needed, as Adil says, you know, what is needed is we do need a free and fair election. We do need a representative government, but not an election as Musharraf was envisaging on January the 8th, which is essentially, which was a rigged election. We need a new consensus on having an election with a new, with new rules of the game for the election commission, an independent judiciary. In other words, we need to reinstall some of the institutions of state which can actually allow a free and fair election to take place. Now, if Musharraf is unwilling, I think he should step aside. If he's not willing to bring about a free and fair election, if he still insists on holding a rigged election, then I think he really is part of the problem, not part of the solution. But I think we need a representative government, and then I think the international community has to stand very firmly by that government and help it and push it and urge it and aid it to resist this enormous threat of extremism that we are facing right now.
Ahmed Rashid in Lahore, Pakistan, thank you so much for being with us. Stephen Cohen, we've just got a minute here. Do you see in Washington the readiness, the courage to really throw its weight right now behind free, fair elections, real democracy in Pakistan, or is it looking for some way to keep Musharraf in there, come what may?
I just think that they're brain dead. They have no ideas about Pakistan. This Benazir saving Musharraf was their last hope, and I think I agree with Ahmed Rashid's analysis. I think the troublesome thing is that if Pakistan's real friends, as the Pakistanis would, Pakistan Army would say, two of them, China and Saudi Arabia, have zero interest in democracy and zero interest in free elections. In a sense, we're battling not only the entrenched interest of the army not to change and the Islamists, the radical Islamists in Pakistan, but also Chinese and Saudi support for their clients in Pakistan. And as Ahmed said, Nawaz Sharif is not the kind of guy who's going to lead a crusade against terrorism. He's going to make his peace with them, but I think they're going to overrun him in the end. Also, we've got a real problem here, and it's going to preoccupy American policy for the next 10 years or so. Pakistan is going to be, as I predicted in my book 4 years ago, is going to be America's largest foreign policy problem.
Ladies and gentlemen, fasten your seatbelts, and our sympathies today to all the Pakistanis mourning the loss of Benazir Bhutto. Stephen Cohen at the Brookings Institution, thank you very much for joining us. Ellen Lapson with the Henry L. Stimson Center and Adil Najam of Boston University, thanks to you all. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.